So it's time for the podcast intro for this week's show. Listener questions, and not just listener questions, but listener questions.
You know, for a long time, we've wanted to do actual questions using the voices of our listeners from around the country. And we're doing it sort of on an experimental basis. And it turned out to be a great experiment. I knew we would get good questions, but I had no idea that the personalities of our listeners would be so fascinating. We can't use all of that in the show, but we got to know some really interesting Jeffersonians.
Yeah, there was a gentleman with a bicycle that was an extended conversation.
Mr. Wes Cheney.
Yeah, what a guy.
He's almost a Thoreauvian, not a Jeffersonian.
Yeah,
he's selling
right.
what he has and moving to Alaska and divesting himself of a number of bicycles, one of which may or may not become the proud possession of the third president of the United States. And one of the things I said to him in our conversation was that the bicycle, we now realize, is one of the single greatest things ever invented, especially now with like titanium frames and they're amazing instruments of efficiency and beauty. But when they first came, this was in England in the 1750s, Samuel Johnson, the great British literary dictator and lexicographer, said, it'll never work, because not only do you have to move yourself, but you have to move the machine too. Like, you're only adding to the burden of movement. He misunderstood the miracle of the bicycle. And just think, I mean, everyone, what your life with bicycles has meant. Remember that moment when you're 6 or 7?
Did Jefferson ride a bike?
No. But remember the moment when you were a child, when you said, don't let go, don't let go,
oh,
don't
sure,
let
yeah.
go, and then
I,
your parents
I remember
let
more
go.
With my sons having them say, don't let go.
But of course you have
One
to.
One of them said, let go, Dad.
And then they're off and running, and they never, for the rest of your life, you know precisely how to ride a bicycle.
It's one of my favorite pictures somebody snapped to me with that moment of the bicycle going up the street and me trying to let go.
You remember your first bicycle?
I do.
My father brought it home from a little town in southwestern North Dakota.
Schwinn?
3 speeds.
Ooh,
it
I
was
didn't
like
get that.
Died and gone to heaven. 3 speeds.
That's I didn't
like
go that, but
a professional racing bike.
Red and white Schwinn with those, what do they call them, the tanks on it?
You know, I bought a really high-end bicycle a few years ago when I moved back to North Dakota. I spent a fortune on it. My friend Melanie Carvel.
This has nothing
Carvel,
to do with the show.
But this is a great story. My friend Melanie Carvel is a world-class triathlete, and so she took me to this bicycle shop, and I bought a bicycle that I really couldn't afford. And the guy who sold it to me was a friend of hers, and he was watching me, and he realized, this is a moron, you know, who's buying a bicycle.
It's a good story.
Yeah, it is. He realizes, this guy is a moron about bikes, and he said to me, well, she left the room to do something. You know, no one would mess with her. She's fabulous. He said, you want me to put streamers on that thing for you? I wanted to kill him, you know. You know, okay, I get it. I'm not a professional.
She said yes.
Yeah, I said, yeah, red, white, and blue, please.
Okay, can I get serious?
But Jefferson did not have a bicycle.
Yes, we really enjoyed doing this program this week. We have always said, and I know you will agree with this, that the heart of the program is the correspondence we get from listeners, the questions. It's inspiring. And, you know, I think both of us have agreed that we're really inspired right now. And doing this show is just a small way to acknowledge how much we owe to our listeners and how much we appreciate our listeners, and particularly those of you who have chosen to support us. We're a listener-supported show and by joining the 1776 Club. I really mean this in all sincerity. Thank you so much. We hope you do enjoy this week's episode of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and please do keep in touch.
It was really something, the geographic spread, the range of personalities. We had extended conversations with some until we realized we just have to go on and get back to the show. But listen now to this fresh edition with the voices of our listeners on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Thanks.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar, author, and creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. And this week, we have a very special show planned, something we've been wanting to do for a long time. We're going to take calls directly from listeners of the Thomas Jefferson Hour and present them to President Jefferson for answers. And that's this week's show.
And people have called in, and we have taken whatever question was on their mind, and you have ask them a little bit about their backgrounds and how they got interested in the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and then they go ahead and ask these great questions. And I had a wonderful time listening to actual listeners?
Great questions we had this week. We had questions about James Callender, about Jefferson and the press.
The postal system.
Patents.
My nails. Well, not my fingernails, but my nail factory.
Banking.
Yes.
We'll get to as many of these as we can fit in during this week's show, but it was one of the things, it was a way for us to say thank you to all of those who have chosen to support the Jefferson Hour via the 1776 Club. You can learn more about that at jeffersonhour.com.
We'll be doing a lot more call-in shows now that the technology is in place.
And yes, yes.
They make me very happy because they remind us that we're not a couple of guys talking in a stall in a barn.
Well, we are.
We're communicating with the nation.
With that, sir, our first caller's on the line. Let's begin.
Hello, Gary Medlin speaking.
Hey, Gary, this is David from the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Hello, David. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Pleasure to talk with you as well, and good day, citizen.
Thank you.
Gary, could you tell us a little about yourself?
Sure. My name's Gary Medlin, and I live in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I've been listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour for probably 10, 12 years, and it's one of my favorite shows. In fact, I have a friend who died recently, and it was his absolute favorite show, and he kind of influenced me to start listening to it.
Well, thank you so much for that, Gary. President Jefferson is here. He's seated across from me now. You have a question for him.
President Jefferson, I'd like to know, and this is if my memory serves me correctly, during the John Adams administration, when you were vice president, that you employed at least one journalist to attack President Adams and his administration. And I believe one of the journalists was James Callender. Is this true? Is my memory correct in that?
Well, not really, sir. Thank you, however, for your question. I was the vice president of the United States in the Adams administration. This is before there was party ticketing for president and vice president, so I was really an opposition leader in some respects. I tried to be as supportive to the Adams administration as I could, but as it went on, I found myself in pretty considerable opposition to the policies of my old friend Adams. And there was a journalist from Scotland by the name of James Thompson Callender who came to this country as a sort of refuge, as a kind of martyr from the persecutions that he had received in Britain. And he began to write about liberty and freedom of expression in this country, and I found what he wrote quite valuable and met him, actually, in Philadelphia and realized that he was destitute. And so over the course of time, I gave him $50 here and $50 there. I saw it as grocery money, really, as helping his family survive during a very difficult period for him. But it was not meant to encourage any scurrilous accounts that he might write against my old friend John Adams.
Well, I stand corrected on that, but how common was the practice of hiring journalists to attack political foes? Was it a common practice in your day?
Not particularly. Most of the founding fathers considered themselves to be gentlemen, and they therefore looked down on mere scribblers, you know, people who in England would have been called Grub Street writers. They weren't sorry that some of these journalists did write against their political enemies, but we kept a pretty considerable detachment from these men. And as I say, I really didn't believe that I was giving money to Callender to attack the Adams administration, and was a little embarrassed when that that appearance became clear to Adams and his wife Abigail and some others of the Federalists. Most of the Founding Fathers wrote themselves, so Hamilton wrote most of his op-ed pieces himself, or his attacks on me or the emerging Democratic Party. Philip Freneau attacked the Washington administration. He was an employee of mine in the State Department. And so the Founding Fathers had a kind of uneasy relationship with these journalists. We weren't sorry that they were doing what they were doing. We wanted to make sure we could claim that we were not directly supporting them. And for the most part, when we had something important to write in opposition to the policies of the other party, we tended to write ourselves, although almost always under pseudonyms, you know, from the classics, so Camillus or Plotinus or Plato or Publius or some other name from ancient Greek and Latin literature.
Well, thanks very much for enlightening me on that, and I'm glad that you corrected my perception on that.
Mr. Jefferson, I think you are being a bit disingenuous. I mean, there's a record of you giving Mr. Callender $50 and encouraging him to publish one of his attack books.
Well, now you're speaking in the way of Abigail Adams, who was not convinced either. But I assure you, my motives were pure.
I apologize, Mr. President. I just wanted to get the record straight.
Well, it was certainly a great pleasure to talk with you, President Jefferson, and certainly wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much, my dear citizen.
President Jefferson, we have our next caller and question for you. Who are we speaking with?
Hello, my name is Ben Lovell from Amarillo, Texas, longtime Thomas Jefferson Hour listener.
And what is your question for the president?
Good day, Mr. President.
Good day to you, citizen.
You were recently quoted by a current president at a campaign rally in an attempt to legitimize his current feud with the press. I believe the quote was, "Nothing can now be believed which is seen in a newspaper. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that polluted vehicle." My question is, what was the context in which you said this, and what was your relationship with the press, and how did it evolve over the course of your presidency?
First of all, let me say that I am absolutely for freedom of the press, that we cannot be a republic unless we have newspapermen whose duty it is to explain the truth to the citizens of the United States. If the people have information, they will be able to make sound decisions about what sort of people they want to represent them in their local offices or in the state government or national government. And wherever there is not a free press, a republic is an essential impossibility. In fact, as a young man in 1787, I said, if I had to choose between newspapers without government or government without newspapers, I wouldn't hesitate to prefer newspapers. But having said that, I realized that one of the paradoxes of freedom of the press is that the press is often irresponsible, and that writers, journalists, newspapermen frequently are biased. They misrepresent the facts. They engage in character assassination. They deliberately distort the policies of an administration or of a public officer, and this is exceedingly frustrating. And I suffered a great deal under this in the course of my time as a public figure, and particularly in the period between 1798 and 1804. So towards the end of my second term as president, I did say the only thing that I trusted in newspapers now were the advertisements, that nothing that was written under the guise of news or opinion could be trusted, and that this had a toxic effect on our national enterprise.
So did negative press ever affect your policy as president?
I don't think that it affected my policies, but it made me more private, and it made me feel that the burden of public office was perhaps not something that I was best suited for. I always panted to get back to Monticello, to my gardens, to my grandchildren, to my books, and so on. And when I was abused for things that I hadn't done, and my record was distorted, sometimes maliciously, by people whose intentions were not to support our republic but to undermine my own legitimacy, that made me long for retirement. But it did at times give me migraine headaches, sir.
Of course. Thank you very much for your response, President Jefferson. It's been an honor.
Thank you, my dear citizen. Keep listening.
I shall.
Mr. President, we have our next questioner coming from Wisconsin. Chris, this is David from the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Oh, David Swenson, it's a pleasure.
The pleasure is ours, sir. I take it you're a Thomas Jefferson Hour listener.
Yes, I am. I have been listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour for several years now, so I am thrilled to be here to participate in this call-in show.
Chris, President Jefferson is seated across from me. What is your question for the president?
Mr. President, with the recent presidential election, I know that it stirred a lot of people up for a call to action, and one of the ways that people can get involved is to run for local office. What advice would you have for someone who is interested in getting involved with local government?
I feel ambivalent about that, citizen. On the one hand, I think that eternal vigilance is the only way we can continue to govern ourselves. In other words, unless you get involved, you effectively have abdicated your control over your own destiny. And I know that if citizens simply pursue their own private happiness, they leave the field open to Mr. Hamilton and his professional minions, whose design is to create a strong central government and a strong permanent military establishment and a national debt and so on. So the price of human liberty is that you must watch at all times the functions of your government, and you must be willing to set aside your private happiness and enter into that arena and to protect your interests and those of your fellow citizens. Having said that, I also believe that that sort of activity is often very demeaning, and it produces a great deal of unhappiness and strain. And I, all the time that I was involved in public life, longed to be back at Monticello with my garden and my books and my children, and I could never really understand why any rational being would want to seek power or to be in the political arena when there's so much discomfort there. So I could never fully reconcile these things in myself, but I know that it's our duty. What sort of government functionary might you become, sir?
I fully believe that government at the local level is the government that has the most effect on the day-to-day lives of citizens, and that is why I'm interested in pursuing an office at that level.
I think you're a Jeffersonian, sir.
Well, thank you. That is the highest compliment anyone can pay to me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we're taking listener questions for President Jefferson. Right now, we need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment.
Hello, everyone. This is Clay Jenkinson. I want to invite you to participate in this year's cultural tour on the Lewis and Clark Trail. It's our 12th time for me going up the Wendover Death March. This is the trip that never gets old. It's the highlight of my year. You'll see why when you come. 3 days on the wild and scenic White Cliffs area of the Missouri River, east of Fort Benton, and then 4 days up on the Lolo Trail, the most pristine part of the entire Lewis and Clark route that starts at Monticello and ends at the shores of the Pacific Ocean. This is my favorite of all the cultural tours. You can sign up. It's July 18th through 27th. You can find out details at Odyssey Tours or jeffersonhour.org. We want to see you on the trail, and I hope that you will take a look at this and other cultural tours. Thanks. We'll see you there.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. This week, we're so pleased to be speaking directly with listeners of the Thomas Jefferson Hour and giving them an opportunity to question President Jefferson directly. Our next caller is Gene Verbate from California. Are you there, Gene?
Hello, this is Gene.
Hi, Gene. This is David Swenson from the Thomas Jefferson Hour. How are you today?
Hi, David Swenson. I'm very well. Thank you for calling.
Where are you from, sir?
I'm in Bodfish, California, which is in the Sierra Nevadas, way at the very south end of the Sierra Nevada Mountains.
Are you a listener to the Thomas Jefferson Hour?
I am a listener. I actually listen by podcast. I live up in the Southern Sierras, and we don't get public radio here, so I listen when I'm out on my daily hike up in the mountains here. I listen to one episode of the Jefferson Hour on the way up the mountain and another one on the way down the mountain.
Well, that's great, sir. Mr. Jefferson is here, and do you have a question for the president?
Well, thank you, Mr. President, for taking my question. I understand that as Secretary of State in the President Washington's administration, one of your responsibilities was to head the United States Patent Office. And I wanted to know, one, if this is true, and two, I'm curious as to what the history of this office is. Was there a patent system in the colonial governments prior to the Revolution or in the British government?
There was what would begin as a patent system under the common law that we inherited from Great Britain. And by the way, thanks for your question. I became the first Secretary of State in the autumn of 1789. In fact, I came back from France to do some business in Virginia and to deposit my daughters there. And I discovered when I arrived at Norfolk that George Washington had named me to be his Secretary of State and that the Senate had approved it. I would not really have wanted that office. I was hoping to go back to France and to see the French Revolution through. But it's hard to turn down the instruction of somebody so revered and important as George Washington. So I took up these duties, and he assured me that they would not be onerous. But the fact is that the Secretary of State at that time had a wide portfolio. In a sense, the Secretary of State was the number two person in the government and was, in some respects, defined as a kind of prime minister. And what I discovered when I became the Secretary in New York City was that one of my duties was to supervise the Patent Office. I actually very much enjoyed this. I got to test every single item. I refused to issue any patents for items that I had not seen with my own eyes, and I sent instructions saying to inventors, you could bring your device to my office anytime between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., and we'll test it, and I'll see if it is unique, because I'm not going to provide a patent intellectual protection of that idea unless it is a unique contribution to humanity. And so I had a really interesting time with this, and I turned down some, frankly, that did not seem to me to have to rise to that standard. Now, I should say one more thing about this. I am not particularly in favor of patents, because a patent creates a kind of temporary monopoly, and it may have the effect of discouraging the spread of good ideas. What if, for example, sir, you developed a vaccine for smallpox, and then by patenting it, you limited its diffusion? There might be tens of people, hundreds of people, maybe millions of people who would die from that terrible disease who would have benefited from your invention had it been more widely distributed. So I want to make sure that we don't in any way discourage the spread and diffusion of ideas that can make man happier and healthier and more productive.
How long was the patent issued for? Was it renewable?
They were not renewable in my time. I don't like the idea of perpetual monopolies in ideas, and I believe that the patents were for about 14 years in this era.
I would assume that that was only within the United States and that Europe wouldn't honor one of the United States patents?
You are correct, sir. There were no international covenants at this time. Let me just ask you a quick question, and then we'll say goodbye. What is your interest in this subject, sir? You're not some sort of inventor out there in California, are you?
Definitely not.
Well, if you do invent something, I hope you will disseminate it as widely as possible, because ameliorating the condition of mankind should be your whole philosophy if you are a Jeffersonian.
Well, I'm definitely a Jeffersonian, and I appreciate you talking to me, Mr. Jefferson.
I hope someday to see those Sierra Nevada mountains. Thank you for calling, sir.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Gary, thanks so much for calling in and supporting the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Before you go, if you've got another minute, I think Mr. Clay Jenkinson would like to speak with you.
So, sir, first of all, thanks for being a part of this today. I'm Clay. And secondly, I think the drought is over down there, isn't it?
Yes, the drought is over everywhere, but on the Central Coast, there's just a little bit of residual still, but we've got more water. I've got a spring on my property that runs down my driveway at about 6 gallons a minute that I can't do anything with. It's crazy right now.
I've spent a lot of time in California, and my favorite drive is along from Mono Lake through Bishop and down on the eastern side of the Sierra.
You betcha. We go from here to Tahoe a lot, and we always take the 395 up the eastern side. It's just fabulous. I had the privilege of listening to you perform every once in a while for the radio station in Fresno, so I got to come see you. I've never seen you do Jefferson. I saw you do Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, maybe you could call that station. I'd like to come back, and when I come back to perform, I do as fundraisers for that station for Valley Public Radio. But one thing I'd like to do is to see Weed Patch, to see the Arvin camp that Steinbeck wrote about in The Grapes of Wrath. I want to know more about that, so I so appreciate it. And tell everyone you know to listen to the Jefferson Hour, please.
Oh, that I do all the time, definitely. Just for your curiosity, I'm a retired educator. I spent 32 years in education, but the last 20 years was spent as traveling California, reenacting the Revolutionary War. I was actually took a character by the name of Andrew Malone, who fought in the Maryland 2nd Regiment. And for 20 years, I portrayed this soldier all over the state of California for elementary and middle school.
Wow.
That's great.
One of these days, we'll have to load muskets together.
There you go. I had a musket, and I had a one-pound cannon, so.
Hey, Gene, thanks a lot for your time this morning, and keep listening.
I will definitely do that. Thank you.
Our next caller is Chris Beach from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Chris, are you there?
I'm here.
And how long have you been a Thomas Jefferson Hour listener?
For approximately 5 years now. I started listening when I lived in Norfolk, Virginia. I lived there for about 5 years and would listen to the Jefferson Hour on my lunch break. And then when I moved back home to Harrisonburg, unfortunately, our local station doesn't carry the Jefferson Hour, so I got turned on to the podcast. So I've been able to keep up that way.
Well, thank you for listening, Chris. Mr. Jefferson is seated across from me now. You have a question for the president?
Yes, I do. It's an honor to be here with you today, Mr. President.
Thank you, citizen.
My question is relating to General Jackson being elected president. We have notes from your conversation with Daniel Webster after learning that General Jackson was going to be elected president. We know that you weren't very fond of the idea of him becoming president. My question is, we are in the beginning stages of an administration with a president who some would say has Jacksonian temperaments and attitudes. What would be your advice to citizens getting ready to embark in this administration? How do we deal with a president who has those types of attitudes?
Well, let me address the question in two different ways. First of all, my attitude towards Andrew Jackson. I knew him somewhat. He was from out in Tennessee, from Nashville. I was from Virginia, and so our paths did not cross very often. He was a militarist, and I am decidedly of a civilian temperament. I knew of his famous work at the Battle of New Orleans, and he came actually to my second home in Virginia, Poplar Forest near Lynchburg, on a march that he made towards Washington, D.C. after the War of 1812 ended, and I entertained him at Poplar Forest. So he's a gentleman. He's a planter. He was by now a war hero. He was lionized at this point by the press in the United States and was well on his way to national fame. Here's the difficulty I have with him. First of all, there's a certain bloodthirstiness about Andrew Jackson. I almost felt that he still had blood on his hands when he came to Monticello. And I think in a republic like ours, we always need to be pretty skeptical about people who come up from military glory. I think that our separation of the civilian authority from militarism is a key protection we have under our constitutional system. So I didn't particularly admire that side of Andrew Jackson. And he was also a duelist. He fought a number of duels and was engaged in a series of affairs of honor. I regard that as a species of medievalism or barbarism. And he was barely literate in some respects. He was not a well-educated man. My dream for this country had been that we would all vote, we would all be involved in self-government, but that when we chose our national officers, we would choose the best men, the most literate, the most thoughtful, the men who had read books, the men who knew languages and had studied the world and were adept in a range of sciences and areas of human knowledge. And that certainly wasn't Andrew Jackson. So I had some misgivings about him, but the fact is he was elected by the people of the United States. Our system is designed to distill the will of the people. And he emerged in 1828 as the president of the United States, and therefore we must respect that.
How do you think that reflects back on the citizenry if we are electing someone who is a dualist, someone who is maybe not as intellectually savvy as we would like it to be?
Well, you wish that the people would do better, but Andrew Jackson went on to be one of the most popular presidents in American history. He's routinely, in your time, regarded as amongst the top 10 presidents of the United States, and his populism had a very positive element to it. He believed that average people were not properly represented, that elitists like Hamilton or James Madison, or for that matter, myself, were at some detachment from the lives of average Americans, and that he would be the first president to really embrace the broad swath of the American people and to try to make the country work as well for them as it had for the people of the upper social orders. And so there's something, I think, admirable in that. I just wish that he had had a little more dignity and a little less violence in his character. And as you probably know, during his famous inaugural, his friends from Tennessee trashed the White House. They tore down drapes and stood on sofas and brought mud into the place and broke windows and so on. And so the people that he loved so much turned out to be vulgarians in some respects, and there was a kind of a mob riot attending his inauguration. That, I think, is not a good sign. I think that whenever a populist becomes president, he must graduate immediately into some level of decorum and dignity, because the president doesn't just represent the people who put him in office. He represents all of the people of the United States, and he represents our republic in the world's arena.
I think that you have answered my follow-up question regarding our new president within that answer, sir. I appreciate it.
Well, the earth belongs to the living. I have no particular opinion of your current president, but if he is a Jacksonian, let's hope that he does whatever he can to embrace the entire citizen body of the United States, and that he lifts this country to a better place in the world's arena and maintains the essence of our Bill of Rights and our Republican system of government.
Well, thank you so much for answering my question, Mr. President. I very much appreciate your time.
You are most welcome, citizen.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. We now have another call from Virginia, from Norfolk, from a Wesley Cheney. Are you there, Wesley?
Oh, my gosh. Is this Clay Jenkinson?
No, this is David Swenson from the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and President Jefferson is here, ready to answer your question, sir.
Wow, David Swenson. I've never actually met you. I've always wished you'd come to Norfolk, Virginia.
Well, thank you, sir. I've been there once, and once is not enough. I should return. I must say I recognized your name as a longtime supporter and listener of the Jefferson Hour, and pleased to speak with you as well, sir.
Well, thank you. I have been listening for, I think, longer than my oldest child is alive, so that would make it about 12 years now. And I have seen Clay Jenkinson and Thomas Jefferson when they visited Norfolk, Virginia. I was able to watch the great debate between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton with much glee and satisfaction.
Well, Maya, you do go back a ways, and you're right in the heart of Jefferson country.
I am. We are so delighted every time you come down to WHRO and I do a presentation there. And then I also talk quite often with Kathy Lewis. She is, in addition to being an amazing radio host, she's also a preacher's wife.
She is an amazing radio host. So I'm taking too much of your time. You have a question for President Jefferson, sir.
I do have a question for Mr. Jefferson. Mr. President, I was listening to another podcast by the name of 99% Invisible, which provided a history of the United States postal system. I was surprised to learn that during your time, postage was paid by the recipient of a letter, not by the sender. What was your annual budget or expenditures for receiving letters?
It's a great question, Mr. Cheney, and thank you so much for asking it. I can't give you an actual dollar amount, but it was considerable. You are correct that the recipient almost always paid the cost of postage, and postage costs more in comparison to one's overall budget in my time than it does in yours. But here's why I didn't begrudge any of that. This was really the only way I had to keep in touch with the world. The newspapers were spotty. They often were weekly newspapers, and one newspaper tended to reprint what it had seen or borrowed from others. And so it was very difficult to stay current. We didn't have any of the media that you so take for granted in your era. And so when we say Republic of Letters, we really meant it, that this is how people exchanged views on the changing political scene, on the policies of any administration, state, local, or national, and it's how scientific ideas were disseminated through the world. And so I hungered for correspondence. In fact, one of the most frequent things that you can find in my letters is a rebuke of my family or my friends for not writing more often, because this was a kind of lifeline to me from the relative remoteness of Monticello to the great world of Boston or Philadelphia or Edinburgh or London. So it was an expense, but it was not an expense that I ever begrudged. I think that we need to have standardized postal rates, and I look forward to the professionalization of Ben Franklin's ideas about the postal service. But compared to other expenses in my life, this was one that I very willingly paid, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. Could you, in relation to perhaps your annual expenditures on books or on wine, how much did you spend on average on postage for letters?
By those comparisons, my postal fees were minuscule. I spent during my presidency, for example, I spent about between $2,000 and $3,000 per year on wine. Now, that was not for personal consumption. That was part of the hospitality that I offered at what you call the White House. At the time, the president was paid a huge salary, $25,000 per annum, but he was expected to pay all of his expenses, and including all of the hospitality that he offered to senators and representatives and foreign diplomats and scientists and men of letters and so on. So this was a very considerable expense. It was very expensive to get true wine from France to the United States in that era. And again, I did not begrudge that. And I spent even more on books. As you know, I cannot live without books. And I had standing book orders at different cities in Europe, Edinburgh and Paris and Frankfurt and London and so on, for any book that pertained in any way to North America, and particularly to the American West. And I had standing orders for books of the Enlightenment, the transactions of the Royal Society and the American Philosophical Society's transactions in the United States, the whatever new editions of the Encyclopedia were coming out in France. And so I spent really money that I didn't have to buy books, because I didn't have any other access to information in so remote a place as Monticello. And books, to me, are the very essence of the way that I was able to see the world. So these are expenses that some would call luxuries, but I would really see them as the cost of being an Enlightenment figure.
Gentlemen, I apologize for interrupting. We need to take a short break. We'll return to this conversation in just a moment. You are listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and this week we have listeners calling in with questions for President Thomas Jefferson. When we took our break, Mr. Wesley Cheney from Virginia was speaking with the president, and Mr. Cheney, I think you had another question.
Mr. President, there's a 21st century movement supported by a podcast called Minimalism, and the key phrase the minimalists come return to again and again is, does this add value to my life? If it does add value to it, then it's worth keeping in my life. It's worth paying for. If it doesn't add value, then it's a hindrance to my life. And when I hear them say that, sir, I am always reminded of your Decalogue and of Benjamin Franklin's commandments as well.
Thank you so much. I think you are a Jeffersonian, and I hope that you will continue to use that metric of deciding what you truly value in life and making sure that you maintain those as priorities as compared to things that turn out to be frivolous or in some ways degrading to human happiness.
I'm very humbled to hear you say that, Mr. President. Thank you.
Thank you, citizen.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. It's time for our next callers, Sophia and Charles Million, calling from Missouri. Hello, are you there?
Yes. Is this Thomas Jefferson himself?
No, this is David Swenson.
Hi, I'm Thomas Jefferson. How are you, madam?
Oh, hello. Well, I've been to your house before. We went there on vacation. And I used to live in Virginia and always thought Monticello was just the most inspirational home around.
And so what part of Missouri are you in?
We're in the Ozarks, South Central.
Okay, that's a beautiful part of the world down there.
Oh, and well, we moved here from L.A. Here we have 10 acres and horses. And
what do you grow?
Happiness.
No rutabagas?
I've done it. Well, sweet potatoes I've grown.
You have all that acreage and you don't have a garden?
You know, either I'm not a really good gardener, or You know, it's really hard. The weather here is very temperamental, and the soil is very limestone. So
I don't like the tone of your voice. I think you should give this another shot.
Easy, Mr. President. Sophia, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Has Charles returned?
It's right here.
Charles, this is David Swenson from the Thomas Jefferson Hour. How are you today, citizen?
Great.
And you have a question for President Jefferson?
Mr. President.
Citizen.
Hi. My question is, from what I've read, you oppose the banking system, central banking or federal banking system, and I was wondering if you could explain what the evils were that you saw in such a system.
Oh, my citizen, where to begin? First of all, I don't like banks, period. But I particularly don't like government banks or federal banks or state banks. Banking is probably a necessary evil. You know, every society has to figure out how to make exchanges. If I have extra bushels of wheat and you have extra chickens, how we make that exchange, and tokens of exchange are apparently inevitable and in some ways very efficient. But banks abstract money and they charge interest, and their interest often compounds, and it's often what in the medieval world would have been called usury. And so I never liked banks, and it's not just that I was always in debt. I have, I think, a principled concern about them. And in my ideal world, we would live in a barter economy in which we exchange things without any tokens of intermediary value whatsoever. But I understand the sort of world that we live in. My bigger concern is Mr. Hamilton's idea of banks, and here's why. If you have a banking system, it can be manipulated. There are people who are very smart about money, who know how to manipulate currencies and manipulate interest rates and manipulate the amount of specie that's in circulation at any given time. This is particularly true of paper money. And so I did not want the government of the United States to be engaged in this. We have our national expenses. We have our tax base. We should pay off our national debt as quickly as possible. But once you have sinking funds and a national debt and a long-term system of administering that debt and eventually paying it off, if at all, you've created a whole range of possibilities for corruption. And corruption is the very antithesis of a free society. So It's not that I don't understand why we need banks, but I do not believe we need a federal banking system.
Well, yes, I think your statement seems like you're almost prophetic in what's happened to our country.
Well, I wouldn't have necessarily known how much prophetic quality these statements have, but I'll just say this: if you and I must have a token of exchange, then I think it should be stamped on a precious metal like gold or silver or even copper, because that metal has intrinsic value. In other words, if the government of the United States disappeared tomorrow, your gold coin would still be usable in Scotland or France or Portugal or Spain. But if you print money on paper, it only has the value that's ascribed to it. And if that government collapses, that money is suddenly of no use, and it's very capable of being inflated and manipulated. You know, we don't ultimately know how many $10 bills Mr. Hamilton has printed. It could be 70, it could be 7 million, and this allows unscrupulous individuals to line their own pockets at the expense of actual value and the expense of farmer citizens.
I don't know how we could reverse it. I do know simply maybe invest in local credit unions and banks that are more local.
Local and not state-sponsored, I think, and banks that you can trust because you know the individuals who run them. But, you know, I was talking to your wife, Sophia, here a moment ago, and she said that you live on 10 acres in the Ozarks and that you have horses. So all of those are good things, for which I congratulate you. But she confessed a little uneasily that you don't have a garden. And if you really share my concerns about the bankers and the money supply and the way that corruption has crept into our system, you must grow at least some of your own food. I want to encourage you to try harder,
oh,
sir.
I think that's a great idea. I think we will give it a good go this year. We will try to do the garden again. I thank you for your encouragement.
A few tomatoes, perhaps, and some potatoes, some corn, some turnips, but peas, above all. The garden pea is my perfect delight, and I'll say this, and I hope you won't take it badly, but if you can't grow a pea, you shouldn't be on that farm.
Oh, right. right.
And avoid banks if you can, sir.
I think it's all good advice. Thank you so much.
And thank you, sir. I hope you enjoyed your conversation with President Jefferson.
Yes, it was wonderful. A bit nervous, but it was wonderful.
He can be an imposing figure at times. He's a brilliant man. But let me introduce you to the gentleman who portrays President Thomas Jefferson, Mr. Clay Jenkinson.
So you go by Chuck or Charles, sir?
I go by Chuck.
All right. Now, it sounds wonderful, this life that you and Sophia have out there.
Yeah, it's great.
It's your idea of wise and simple is exactly, I think, what Thomas Jefferson had in mind. And did she say you had been in Los Angeles?
Yes, we moved here about 10 years ago from Los Angeles and never looked back. I think Jefferson actually, didn't he expound on that about people living one on top of another?
Yes, cities are so many cancer sores on the face of the landscape. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today, sir.
Thank you so much for the show. I really enjoy it.
And now it's time to bring President Jefferson back for our final call this week. Bart Daly from Utah. Are you there, Bart?
Yes, I am.
And you have a question for President Jefferson.
Thank you for taking my question, Mr. Jefferson.
You're most welcome.
I wanted to speak to you about a letter you received from James Madison, dated 24th October, 1787. In this letter, Mr. Madison communicated to you the general outcome of the recently finished federal convention. And in this letter, he also enumerated the great objects of the convention, outlining the procedures for accomplishing them. I am seeking clarification on just two objects, numbers one and two. To wit, he remarked that the convention had attempted to reconcile the following. Number one, to unite a proper energy in the executive and a proper stability in the legislative departments with the essential characters of Republican government. And number two, to draw a line of demarcation which would give to the general government every power requisite for his purposes, general purposes, and leave to the states every power which might be most beneficially administered by them. He later remarks that the federal government must be the check on individual rights, which might be infringed upon by the states. Here is my question. Knowing that Madison was friends with Washington, and understanding that Washington, angry with the states, whose character was on display during the War for Independence, wished for a central government that could compel the states to act in the interest of the Union. Is it your belief that Mr. Madison himself wished that the federal government he helped create would have total supremacy over the states and be the final arbiter of laws in all matters? Or is Mr. Madison the eternal pragmatist working to maintain civility? I ask this because he seemed to be equally at home in two very different administrations.
It's a great question, and it's a complex one, so let me try to address it as briefly as I can, sir, but thank you for it. Madison was the father of the Constitution. I was not at the Constitutional Convention. He and I had corresponded pretty considerably about that process before they closed the doors at Philadelphia between May and September of 1787. And what emerged was a much stronger central government. The perception was, and you're right to locate it primarily in General Washington, the perception was that the government had been insufficiently strong and consolidated and centralized during the War of Independence, and that this had made the war much more difficult, more expensive, less efficient, and more prolonged, and that now that we were going to be a new nation, that we needed a stronger government than the Articles of Confederation had envisioned. I sometimes agree with that, and I certainly agree with it to a certain extent, but I don't entirely agree. I think that the states are the most competent jurisdictions for our happiness, and so I prefer to call myself a Virginian than an American, and I think we're better off if the states are sovereign in every possible way except those few things that are truly national and international in scope. Now, that puts me at odds with George Washington, certainly. It also puts me at odds with my closest friend and collaborator, James Madison. We all understood that there were certain weaknesses in the Articles of Confederation, but I think that the instrument that they produced at Philadelphia is too powerful, too centralized, and gives much too much authority to the national government as opposed to state and local governments. I was pleased when the Bill of Rights was appended, and the 10th Amendment says quite emphatically those powers not delegated by the Constitution to the national government belong instead to the states and to the people. Unfortunately, I think that 10th Amendment has been routinely ignored in the course of American history. When I came back from France in the autumn of 1789, Madison and I renewed our ancient friendship, and at that point he began to drift away from his Hamiltonian centralization towards more of my states' rights view of the best happiness for humankind. That upset and bewildered Colonel Hamilton, but I think that Mr. Madison's truest instincts were those that put as much authority as humanly and practicably possible in state government rather than in the national government. I hope that at least begins to clarify that.
It does indeed, Mr. President. I thank you for your time and for allowing me to answer your question.
And we thank you, Mr. Bart Daly from Provo, Utah. And that's all the time we have this week for listener questions, although there are certainly more to come, Clay.
Let's do a lot of this. This is really fun.
It is. It's great to have people be able to talk directly with President Jefferson. They were this week, they were very kind to him, very respectful.
Well, it won't always be that way. And when you're talking to them before they come on the air, you say, go ahead and challenge Mr. Jefferson. He needs it.
I was a little surprised that we didn't have more women calling in to speak to President Jefferson.
We need gender equality in this.
Well, perhaps they're frightened of Mr. Jefferson and his stance on women.
Certainly not. The tender breasts of ladies were
not
formed for political
convulsion. I know one young
woman
I would love to have call us.
Who might that be?
Do you know who I'm speaking of? The lovely Catherine.
Oh, my child. Well, she's been a guest host on this program, widely admired for her rudeness.
Game the business. Anyway, we are out of time for questions this week, and now it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch. Clay?
Thank you, David. I've been performing as Thomas Jefferson for more than 30 years. In that time, I've spoken to 28 state legislatures, to Supreme Court justices, including Anthony Kennedy, Antonin Scalia, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Byron White, and Sandra Day O'Connor, and to two presidents, George H.W. Bush and William Jefferson Clinton. I have, by conservative estimates, performed as Jefferson 5,000 times. I've been on The Colbert Show, on Politically Incorrect, on The Today Show, and in three of Ken Burns' documentary films, including his 1998 study of Jefferson. Some form or other of the Jefferson Hour has been around now for a very long time, first in Reno, and more recently at the New Enlightenment Radio Network Barn here in North Dakota. In the course of this long relationship with Jefferson, I have fallen in love with him again several times and out of love too. Like an old married couple, we have our moments. There are times when I can hardly stand to be in the same tights with Jefferson, and other times when I feel the privilege of hitching my intellectual pony to the cart of the American Enlightenment's greatest single figure. Almost no week goes by when I don't learn something new about Jefferson. And over the course of months or years, my perspective on the third president changes. New approaches come to my head in the middle of the night or while I am sitting in the Little Missouri River out in the badlands of western North Dakota. But I am happiest when I am talking with real people in America. I light up during the Q&A sessions of my performances when I am engaged with some actual American citizen who has a question she or he really wants answered by one of America's most remarkable men. People who follow my work invariably say that while they like the unscripted monologue, they really enjoy my energy, sharpness, and engagement during the Q&A. That's how I feel, too. Today we institute a new feature of the Jefferson Hour. Friends of the program, in this case members of the 1776 Club, call in with their questions. I don't know what they're going to be in advance. I always want to keep it spontaneous. It gives me such joy to know that you're out there, that you find the work of the Jefferson Hour helpful or compelling, that you believe in a nuanced and non-simplistic understanding of Thomas Jefferson and the founding generation, and that you wish to extend what Jefferson called the Republic of Letters and the Enlightenment at a time when there is widespread disillusionment with our civic culture. I take all of this as a sacred trust. It inspires me, and it delights me. I am so mighty privileged to have this responsibility, to play this role to get to look at the universe from the transit of Venus to the gardens of Monticello through the eyes of one of the most fascinating individuals ever to have walked the face of the earth. Not that Jefferson was always a creature of light, but hey, which one of us is? Benito Mussolini wanted his epitaph to read, "Here lies one of the most intelligent animals who ever appeared on the face of the earth." That's ludicrous for the fascist dictator, but it makes some sense for Jefferson, but Jefferson was so modest that he would never, ever have talked about himself in that way. I'm Clay Jenkinson. Join us again next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.